warning is fine against Ryan International Airlines. Mr. Grace.
Police court. This case began in the district court as a multi-complaint, multi-part complaint against my client Ryan. One of the individual tort count was dropped before we ever got to trial. The discrimination claims went out on summary judgment as a matter of law, with Judge McKinney ruling that no reasonable minds could differ, but that there were no facts upon which to base a discrimination claim against Ryan by the plaintiff's firm. What was not dropped was the retaliation claim. We argued then, and we argued during trial, and in conjunction with the motion in limine, and in post-trial motions, basically always the same thing. If reasonable minds cannot differ, but that there are no facts to support a claim of discrimination, then how can there be, as a matter of law, a position where a plaintiff can have a reasonable, good faith belief that she was opposing discriminatory conduct? If there is no discrimination, no objective evidence to support it at all, don't we get into the line of cases in this circuit and elsewhere that basically says it has to have some merit, and it didn't. Anyway, long story short.
It looks to me like you're asking us to overrule a fair number of cases that have said exactly the opposite of what you seem to be arguing here. What I understand your argument to be is that because we'll assume summary judgment was proper on the underlying discrimination claim, then that in itself is enough to defeat, as a matter of law, the retaliation claim because of the way you interpret the reasonable belief in good faith standard. But there are quite a few cases that have said that's in fact not the standard, and in fact as long as the person who is exercising protected rights such as filing a complaint is acting in reasonable good faith and it's not totally groundless. I think that's the language used in McDonnell against Cisneros, for instance. Then the retaliation claim can go forward. And so the case law draws a distinction right now, which I guess you're arguing we should overrule.
No, that is not our position. There can certainly be a case, if I understood the question correctly, there certainly can be cases where a person can file a discrimination complaint, fails for some reason or another.
On summary judgment?
In some cases, I suppose it could, yes. But what the cases we're talking about, like, for example, McDonald, Visser, and others, are saying is that the discrimination case, the underlying discrimination complaint, cannot be totally without merit.
Well, what
and this
McDonald
claim is totally without merit.
Well, but that's what McDonald does say is, though, that even if it's without merit for purposes of surviving summary judgment on, in fact, these are often dual counts in cases, and even if it's proper to grant summary judgment for the employer on the discrimination claim, there are many cases where a retaliation claim goes forward because the claim of a violation of Title VII isn't completely groundless. There's some merit to it. And the jury here was asked and decided that that there was sufficient merit, that there was a reasonable belief, not just good faith, but reasonable belief.
That's where we disagreed with the district court, and I disagree with your analysis of what you've said thus far.
Well, that's what the jury was asked, right? You thought reasonable.
No.
Yes, it was. You thought reasonable should have been defined, but the actual phrasing is certainly reasonable belief. We've got it right here. attended to her brief.
Is this our brief, Your Honor, or the?
Well, question one of the plaintiff's brief, which is.
What page, please?
It's right at the end, and it's stamped A153. It's the special verdict form, and it says, did the plaintiff, Lisa S. Fine, prove that she reasonably believed in good faith? And that was what I was quoting from.
Right.
So
that's what the jury found.
Right. So they find she reasonably believed in good faith.
Given the instructions given to them, and given the evidence the judge permitted, they were only considering the question, not of whether there was any merit to a discrimination claim, but whether there was a reasonable belief in the merit of the discrimination claim.
Right.
The entire trial.
Why is that wrong under the law if you look at McDonald against Cisneros and actually quite a few other cases?
Okay.
Alexander against Gerhardt Enterprises, for instance.
Let's take McDonald.
Practically a quote from.
Well, take McDonald against Cisneros. A portion of it decided in 1996 that I'm referring to, page 5 of the opinion, talks about. Now, just read it. It is improper to retaliate for the filing of a claim of violation of Title VII, even if the claim does not have merit, provided it is not completely groundless.
Right. Right.
Her claim of discrimination set forth in her October 2nd letter to Looney and Scott was and remains completely groundless. There was no evidence to support it.
Believe me, I understand that that's your position and that you presented it and that you had, I would never in a million years say this wasn't a jury issue. You had evidence, she had evidence.
No,
but
no,
the jury
we did not.
Rejected your position.
Ma'am, respectfully, we did not, we put on plenty of evidence that her original discrimination claim was groundless.
Right, that's what
they
I mean.
They put on none, that it had objective factual merit. The judge had already ruled as a matter of law.
Well, I don't know about
that.
There
was no merit to a discrimination claim.
The issue they had to prove, though, was that she reasonably believed that it did have merit.
That is a different issue.
But that's
that
what,
if it has merit.
That's the language of Alexander against Gerhardt Enterprises.
She
somebody
had,
has a retaliation claim so long as she reasonably believed in good faith that the practice she opposes, the language Judge McKinney picks up.
I don't have Alexander in front of me. I have Vass Visser. I have Little, and
well,
I
mean, we
McDonald, but the cases all seem to say the same thing. Assuming
I think you are. I mean, I don't know why you're resisting this. It seems to me that you are, in fact, arguing for a modification of Seventh Circuit law in this.
No.
If that's what you want to do, be my guest. You know,
I have no problem arguing to modify the law if that's what I think I have to do. My problem here is I don't think there is any Seventh Circuit law that directly covers the situation unless you read the tail end that comes in every one of these cases, which says, as it did in McDonald, that provided it is not completely groundless. We tried the lawsuit on did she have a reasonable belief in what in effect was a groundless discrimination claim. Now, I still think as a matter of law, and if this requires modification, then let's modify it, that if her claim is as a matter of law groundless, and that's what Judge McKinney ruled, and nobody's appealed it, if the discrimination claim is groundless, without
where did he rule her claim was groundless as opposed
summary
to
judgment?
Now, where did he rule that her claim is groundless?
Oh, I don't
you
think
seem to think that there's no difference between groundless and incorrect.
This case, he ruled not incorrect. He said there was no evidence upon which the claim could be based. And I'm not quoting your summary judgment opinion precisely; it's part of the record. He did not rule that there was something legally deficient about the October 2nd letter she wrote and the complaint she made against Lillian Scott. What he ruled was that there was no evidence to support any of those claims. They were only her beliefs and opinions, and there was no evidence to support them. No reasonable mind could conclude there had been discrimination, and that's why summary judgment was sustained.
And your position is she couldn't have a reasonable belief that there was a discrimination under those
I cases. Still take the position that if you cannot, as a matter of law, or excuse me, if the judge rules you can't have reasonable minds differ, but that there's no evidence to support discrimination, then how can a jury be allowed to consider that reasonable minds could concur she had a reasonable belief in that discrimination?
And
you got no evidence, you don't have a lawsuit.
I have trouble imagining the set of cases that you seem to think exists where a plaintiff starts out with two theories of recovery.
Right.
Theory one, discrimination. Theory two, retaliation. And the judge grants summary judgment on theory one, and the retaliation claim is based on a complaint about what the plaintiff thought was the discrimination. I don't see how under your view of the law there would ever be a case that you didn't automatically also grant summary judgment on the retaliation claims based on your theory.
Oh, I can give you one. Really?
All right, sure.
Let's say for whatever reason, the event she complained of in her letter to Looney and Scott with Ryan. Geez, a little too informal here.
What about
the event she complained of were events that all took place on, basically, on or after April 25th, 1996, when she failed her recheck as a co-pilot for the second time. Well, there wasn't any problem with timing on that. She complained in time. She filed her EEOC complaint time. Everything happened. Let's say for whatever reason, the same series of events occurred, and she just sat there and mulled over and was unhappy. But they'd occurred on April 25th, 1994. And she goes to the lawyer, and for whatever reason, they filed a lawsuit. Well, there the case goes out. Not because of there not being discrimination, and not because she didn't have a good faith belief, and maybe they got a letter saying, we're going to discriminate against her. Maybe she got all the smoking guns in the world. But because of time ran. She still has room for a good faith belief. But when she makes a discrimination claim, to which she was forced to admit in trial and in deposition, which led to summary judgment, that she never had any evidence to support it. Never had any facts. They were just her opinions and beliefs. And then at trial, what she ended up doing, or what ended up happening when the evidence came in, was she was able to bootstrap up the reasonableness of her belief that she must have been discriminated against, on which there was no evidence that she was. She would bootstrap that up by a series of other events, all coming in the context of conversations she had with other people. Like with her disgruntled other pilots, no longer worked for Ryan,
and other unnamed sources, frankly, in a lot of cases.
All the women who had joined together in the September letter, who all seemed to have the perception that there was sex discrimination at this workplace.
Well, three of them testified. The fourth one did not. And
but they all wrote the letter.
Yes, they all four signed the letter.
So, I mean, that's
yeah,
what I'm...
They consented to it. Sure, yeah, no question. Yeah. And they were all asked to give specific examples so we can get on and investigate and see what happened. For example, we heard 3 days of testimony from the three of the four pilots who testified about how people would say things about, well, the pilots have great asses. Well, who? Well, I didn't know. Well, when did it happen? Well, we can't say. And in some of the instances where they'd say that certain things had happened in their training they thought were discriminatory, we would want to put on evidence, but the judge had already ruled consistently that we could not put on evidence to rebut those things. That's another one of our gripes. Excuse me, issues on appeal. Because we were in a situation where we went to try the merit or lack of merit of her discrimination claim.
But you were trying her retaliation claim because
all we had left was retaliation. Right.
On
absolutely.
The other two. And so you needed to explain why she didn't have at least a reasonable belief that the test had been rigged and that the male pilot was getting access to his file and she wasn't, and that.
Yes, ma'am.
You know, the series of evidence that's reviewed in the brief that she did have to point to say that there was, in fact, that she thought there was discrimination. They were told after the September letter people have got to file individual complaints. She did, and the second she writes the October 2 letter like that, she's fired. So that was the case you were trying, right?
That's the case you were trying on the reasonableness of her belief. There's no question there's a temporal between she writes a letter telling Looney and Scott all the things they've done wrong, which they, of course, as the chief operations people of the company, know didn't happen.
And she got mad about it.
Huh?
She says in the letter that she thinks it's sex discrimination.
Right. I know she says in the letter she thinks it's sex discrimination. The underlying facts are the things that Looney and Scott knew when they received the letter.
Why didn't they investigate them?
Pardon?
Why wasn't there an investigation?
There was an investigation.
No, there wasn't. Not after the October 2 letter.
Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry, I disagree. That's been labeled that way by plaintiff's counsel. The letter was received by...
the human resources officer conducted an investigation.
She could not conduct an operations investigation, particularly the vice president of operations and the chief pilot of the company.
She's not
anyway.
The person responsible for investigating these complaints at the company?
She is the person responsible for investigating complaints of ordinary sexual harassment, sexual discrimination, things about which she has knowledge. The primary witness...
Most companies have, you know, a person designated.
That's her.
That went under the complaint system presumably most of the time these people won't know about it. A complaint's filed, and then they institute an investigation. They interview whoever they need to interview. They collect data. And you're saying that that's, in fact, not her responsibility?
That is her responsibility normally in this particular instance, because Looney was a vice president of operations and up the totem pole from her. She felt more comfortable giving the matter to him. He, in fact, and she had talked with their outside counsel, Jack McIntyre, with the company president, Ron Ryan, Looney and Scott, and I think somebody talked to Jeff Crippen, but Crippen didn't know a whole lot about it. The fact of the matter is, the items that are being accused of here were known operationally to be wrong.
But wait a minute. So
the
under
they got
your
the letter.
Company's procedure, even though her letter, which is reproduced at page 11 of her brief, indicates in a couple of paragraphs that Looney is one of the people who's doing the discrimination, it's your company's policy that that's also the person who does the investigation?
No, ma'am. That is not the normal policy.
But it was the policy here.
It was the event that occurred here because the policy did not fit the normal situation. Here they were claiming.
Here, even though he's the one she's complaining about, McGoldrick doesn't do the investigating. It says to Looney, you do it.
If she had written a letter saying, Looney.
That's what she did. That's what the October 2 letter says.
If she had written a letter saying that Looney had made sexually improper remarks or advances or something of that nature, no doubt in my mind, Mary McGoldrick would have.
You're distinguishing between operations, flight operations, and any other activity in the corporation.
The flight and testing operations.
No, that's part of the training for the
training
flight.
For flight. Yes, sir. McGoldrick doesn't know anything about this. Absolutely nothing. They're all technical operations. And
all
the
I'm
people she goes to tell her, as they told Looney, that they'd had problems with fines to some degree in the past. A lot of run-ins, a lot of conflicts and stuff. But the things are in there just simply didn't happen. She's accusing Looney, for example, of rigging her testing situation. He never gets anywhere near the testing program. He's out in Denver. He's in Wichita. He doesn't have anything
to
do with
it. But you're addressing, in a sense, the merits. That all may be...
Yeah, that is the merits of it.
But the point is, in a usual... company procedure for investigating complaints, if the complaint is even that the president of the company didn't allow me to get training, or if the president of the company evaluated my flight skills in a discriminatory way, it wouldn't be the president of the company who would do the investigation. It would be somebody with some patina of neutrality looking at it. Human resources person, or the outside counsel, or usually
outside somebody. Counsel here was involved. That's part of it. And I'm not meaning to correct the fight, but the outside counsel was consulted because of the fact the operations vice president was the one being accused of these things.
Right.
But they've got to investigate. They have to go to someone that knows something about the operations, because Mary McGoldrick would not know, and neither did Lisa Fine. Apparently, Looney has nothing to do with even setting the dates for training. He couldn't rig the date she's going to get trained. It has nothing to do with it. It's all done out by a guy named Walker out of Denver. Which, by the way, she knew she was set.
I'm sorry.
Were you the trial lawyer?
Mm-hmm.
Representing the trial?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry. I used up my air and most of my water here for a second. Yes, I was. We spent 8 days there. And what we ended up, there was no evidence ever put on by plaintiffs that any of the allegations, the factual allegations set forth in that letter of October 2nd, were factually accurate. The most she could come down with was, I thought they were. And why she said she thought they were was that she and the other two pilots testified they thought there was, I'm not using their words because they didn't say it this way, but this was the effect of it all, an overall cloud, a permutation, just discrimination throughout the company, a lot of opinion testimony. And we had no other way to deal with that at that point, because that came... Frankly, the opinion on limine would have kept all that out of evidence. Now, I know the judge can change the limine opinion, but that theory wasn't even coming in. But when she got into it, and when they got into it right at the first of plaintiff's case, and that's all the evidence they basically put on, we started asking. We never got anything we could pin down. It was like playing with smoke in a way. There was never the name of any male given who was ever treated differently than any of these witnesses.
What about the man who got access to his file? I forget his name.
Yes, ma'am.
There was a pilot who got access to his file.
That is correct.
Told, no, you can't have access to your file because we've got confidential information in it.
A letter was written and placed into evidence, which was sent to Ms. Fine, in which she admitted receiving, from Scott, not Looney, she had the wrong name, who told her if she wanted to come down during regular working days, she can see the file. She never went down.
The whole file or a redacted?
I don't remember without seeing the letter, and I don't know that there was anything in the file to redact. We never got to that level.
But they told her that there was that there were confidential evaluations from other pilots in the file.
Looney told her that there... I'm sorry, excuse me. Thanks, it's not polite for me to interrupt.
Oh, no, no, I was just finishing the thought, but you already were there, so you can answer.
Yeah, no. My memory, and I've got so much of this running around, I've got more memory than I've got knowledge right
more
now.
More than
probably.
Time, probably.
She said that Looney said that the pilots would sometimes give debriefings after flights, and that some of those were kept in the personnel file. He didn't know if there were any in hers or not, one way or the other. Scott wrote her and told her to come during regular hours to get the file, and she wanted debriefing reports, which are standard with Ryan. And I'm assuming there may have been some in the file. I don't know. But she never came in. And if she wanted to get those, present some reason for it, and they'd look at it or something to that effect. I don't remember what the letter said. I really don't.
Okay.
But I know he wrote her. I know she admitted getting the letter. I know she never went in. And it never came out in trial. I don't know where they stand or what was in her file. Except I don't remember seeing any debriefing reports. But then that's, boy, don't even strike that because I've seen too many files over too many years. The bottom line, uh-oh, is that I got to red before I got anywhere near my 15. Sorry? I'd like to fish for another 15 minutes, but I don't suppose it'll do me any good.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Lazar.
May it please the court, I would like to first address the cross-appeal that the plaintiff, Lisa Fine, has filed in this matter. The first issue being that of attorney's fees. The judge, the district court judge, found that the hours that were spent by counsel for the plaintiff were reasonable, that there was no contest by the defendants of the hourly rate, that the results achieved were excellent, and in fact, the amount that was awarded to our client was the maximum that could have been awarded, even had she won each of the sex discrimination, sex harassment, retaliation claims, she could have achieved no more in the way of monetary results than what she did achieve. Although the sex discrimination and harassment claims were dismissed on summary judgment, a very persuasive line of cases from this circuit says that is to no avail to the extent that the facts are intertwined. And they were here. The attack throughout the trial was that our client did not have a reasonable belief in her claims made earlier of discrimination and harassment. So there was an intertwinement, a core issue, if you will. What the judge did, though, is he went to a case that had been cited where the trial court had reduced fees where the discrimination and harassment claims were tried, which they were not here. In Meriwether, the claims were tried, and that judge had reduced the attorney's fees by 10%. And Judge McKinney said, well, it was good enough for the judge in Meriwether, I'll do that here. That's an arbitrary decision. It's not a clear and concise explanation.
Arbitrary might be a harsh word. I mean, this is an abuse of discretion standard that we have here, and it looked to me like Judge McKinney was basically saying there's a lot of overlap, maybe 90% overlap, but there's a portion of the case on which you didn't prevail, and he makes the rough estimate that a 10% adjustment is appropriate. So that's what he does. And it seems to me that you have to be arguing that because the money was unaffected, then it was automatically an abuse of discretion to adjust it by even a dollar. And I don't see that in the law.
The cases that we cite in our brief, and I won't go through them in the detail, state that the fact that you lose other claims, that to the extent there is the kind of intertwining of issues as we have here, that's not a basis for reducing the attorney fee award. If you're going to reduce the award, you need a clear and concise statement and explanation of why. We don't have that in the district court's opinion. We simply have, they lost these cases on summary judgment, or these claims, I mean to say, and I'm going to do what the judge in Meriwether did. And I see nothing beyond that as far as an explanation of what he's done. If the judge had gone through perhaps our billing records, which were available to him, and said, well, this clearly was something that would not have been expended in this case, and identified perhaps by billing entry what should be reduced, that would be a clear and concise explanation. We don't have that.
I know you want to talk about the cross appeal, but I want to make sure you spend, you leave enough time to do the following, which is to give us a summary of what you think the evidence at trial was that showed that Ms. Fine had a reasonable belief in good faith that there was discrimination that she was complaining about in the October 2 letter.
Certainly. I'll attempt to do so in bullet point highlight form. First, she's not the only one who came to the conclusion. She was one of four senior female pilots, in fact, the four senior female pilots who met in August of 1996 and recounted the different treatment in training that they had experienced, that they felt like they were given inadequate opportunities in training and that they were perhaps treated differently than the males in training, such as Lisa Fine pointed out that just 4 months earlier, in April of that same year, that she had appeared for a PC check and had been denied a warm-up. It was strict company policy at Ryan that before you take a PC check, you get a chance to warm up on the machine. The machines differ. They're calibrated differently. You get a chance to get the feel of this machine before you take your check. She was told, no, you will not. She
wasn't she told she was a day late?
She was told she was a day late. That's correct. And she said, and the evidence was there for the jury to credit her on this, that she, in fact, was told to be there on the very day that she did appear. And did appear on the day that she was told she should be there. And that there was no evidence of any other pilot who had been required to take a PC check without a warm-up.
So basically the day late testimony was a contested issue of fact, and it's your position the jury resolved it in Ms. Fine's favor.
Correct. The August of 96 meeting also discussed stereotyping of the female pilots by physical attributes. Some were buffalo butts, some were Lisa Fine being in the fortunate group.
Was there attribution to those statements?
At the meeting in August, it was simply a discussion of the male pilots speaking of them that way. Now, there was confirmation at the September 18th meeting, which I was going to get to in a minute, where there was a meeting between three of the four female pilots and Ryan top management, where Looney, the at the time vice president of operations, did confirm that the female pilots were called whiners, criers, that Lisa was known as fine wine, that they were known as being weak pilots.
Was that statement in response to a question she asked? What did they say?
The statement was made during the...
In other words, did Fine ask Looney, well, what do they think of me, or what do they say?
I'm not certain of that. I just know that Mr. Looney did confirm that these statements were being made at the September 18th meeting. It may have been that it was in response to a question from Ms. Fine. I don't recall how it actually came up. But the fact, I think the important one being that confirmation came from the Vice President of Operations that in fact, the female pilots were in fact being stereotyped in these fashions, as bitch, crier, whiner, Ms. Fine being fine wine, that the in flying ability they were stereotyped as being weak, won't fly with this person. Ron Ryan had, and the testimony came in response to Lisa Fine when she said, this male pilot says good things about my flying ability. Well, the only person who says good things about your flying ability, you're having an affair with him. You're sleeping with him. This kind of putting the female pilots in their place was, in fact, what was discussed at the August meeting, was, in fact, what prompted the September 6th of 1996 letter, where the four senior female pilots, and if you look at the Holland case, which is...
who was at the August meeting?
The August meeting were four female pilots, Julie Chaplot, Jeannie Smith, Vicki Ramos, Lisa Fine. Those four were the four senior female pilots at Ryan Airlines.
I mean, that's who else? That was it? Just the four of them?
Four of them happened to be in the same airport at a layover and got together and met and talked. It wasn't a scheduled meeting where all female pilots were contacted, do you want to come? They happened to be at the airport and had known each other for a while as the senior pilots, and during this layover they met. It was an informal meeting, not a formal meeting. The letter came in September. The meeting was held September the 18th, 12 days after the letter was written. At this meeting was Danny Looney, Mary McGoldrick, the Director of Human Resources, and again, the discussion was had as to what are your complaints. At the end of the meeting, the women were told by Danny Looney, if you want us to look into this, if you want us to investigate, you must put your complaints in writing. But, and this was a sign of things to come, he warned, if you do that, if you complain about the male pilots, in other words, they will stop carrying you, covering up for their deficiencies as pilots, and instead begin writing you up. Right there, he told them, pretty directly, I don't think in very veiled terms whatsoever, that if you go ahead and put in writing your claim of discrimination, you will be retaliated against. They won't carry you anymore. They'll write you up instead.
Well, were any of these actions sufficient to be sex discrimination?
Were the actions sufficient to be sex discrimination? The district court found no, but in Lisa Fine's mind, not being a lawyer, not
having... Are we retrying the issue of discrimination rather than retaliation there?
We're attempting to establish the reasonable belief that Ms. Fine had in her...
But your argument is more that these, that the district judge was wrong, that these really were discriminatory acts.
My argument is that Lisa Fine reasonably believes that they were discriminatory acts. I do not choose to, and have not, in fact, appealed the summary judgment that was issued against my client on a discrimination claim.
No necessity to do that, is
there? There is no necessity to do that, and I have not. I'm simply attempting to establish, I believe, in response to Judge Wood's request to establish the facts that underlie the reasonable belief of my client and three others in their claims of sexual discrimination.
And so it's your position that you did not, by the time this was just a retaliation case, have the burden of conducting a mini-trial on the discrimination claims, that you didn't have to come forward with evidentiary quality materials that would have actually convinced a jury that there was discrimination.
That is absolutely correct. That was our feeling and belief under the line of cases that I heard discussed with Mr. Grace and the panel, that it was not necessary for us to do that to establish our client's reasonable belief.
So what do you see the difference between the reasonable belief, reasonable is a word that has objective overtones to it, and the objective evidence that Mr. Grace is arguing we should be looking for? What's the gap here?
I'm not sure that I see the gap. Mr. Grace cites the Little case from the 11th Circuit as authority for his different view of what is or isn't reasonable and what instruction should have been given. If I read the Little case, they say that subjective reasonableness goes to the good faith, and objective reasonableness goes to, well, but was it reasonable? And that's the very instruction that the judge said. Ms. Fine must, in good faith, subjective reasonableness, have a reasonable belief, objective reasonableness, in her claims of discrimination.
Well, that women were being treated differently from men because they were women.
Correct.
Okay.
On the 9th of October, Ms. Fine's October 2nd letter is received. Rather than conducting the investigation, which the handbook and the policy on discrimination, sexual harassment specifically, states will take place, Mary Goldrick does what? She takes the letter to the individual that was the primary focus of Ms. Fine's complaint of discrimination, Vice President of Operations Danny Looney. He gets angry and he sets out to prepare a case to justify termination of Ms. Fine. Tellingly, smoking gun tellingly, he acknowledges at trial that until he's shown this letter, he had no thought of firing Ms. Fine. All of the evidence that was given about poor attendance, about inability to get along with others, this is a smokescreen that is developed by Mr. Looney after he sees the letter on October the 2nd.
There was no prior documentation in her file of those alleged problems?
There was no documentation of any disciplinary action. There was no documentation of the progressive discipline that would take place on things like attendance, which in fact Ryan's own policy manual required. No warning, this is a problem, take care of it. None of that. There were, I think, in her file some things about Lisa got into a something with a scheduler today. But Lisa was never told this is a problem. So there was no progressive discipline. Danny Looney said, I never even had a thought of firing Lisa Fine until after I was shown this letter that she wrote of complaint. But they lied to her. They told her, hey, you're being fired because of poor attendance, and you're being fired because of inability to get along with others. It's a smokescreen. It's a sham. It's a further sham because although there was the appeal hearing, which was chaired by Ron Ryan, the CEO and owner of Ryan International Airlines, he, when shown the letter by Mary McGoldrick, close in time to its arrival on October the 9th, said, if I were her boss, I'd fire her ass. Now, Ron Ryan had conducted no investigation of her allegations, yet he concluded by simply looking at the allegations of discrimination that were he her boss, he would fire her ass, and that's a quote. Danny Looney, who, according to Ryan's own policy, should not have been the one doing the investigation, doesn't do an investigation of the allegations that don't involve him. Instead, he sets out to construct a case for firing Ms. Fine. Mary McGoldrick, who is given the trust by the company and the after Ellworth, what are you supposed to do? You think you've been discriminated against? You think you've been harassed? You have to come forward. The company has an internal grievance procedure. You have to do it or else you're out. Well, she comes forward. The company says, we'll investigate. They don't investigate. Mary McGoldrick, the person that if your supervisor is harassing you or discriminating against you, come to our human resources director. She'll investigate. Bypass the supervisor. That's what Lisa Fine does. She writes the letter. She sends it to the director of human resources. She immediately trots it down the hall to Danny Looney, who sets about constructing a case to fire her. For these reasons, punitive damages not only were justified, but the punitive damages were not excessive. Ryan says that their conduct did not warrant punitive damages. Well, Kolstad is the controlling law here, of course, and there are three elements that say that their conduct did warrant punitive damages. First, did they have knowledge that their actions may have violated federal law? Well, each of them, the major players, that is, Ron Ryan, Danny Looney, and Mary McGoldrick, testify that they were quite familiar with Title VII. McGoldrick said, in fact, that she had provided each of the top managers with training and had specifically informed them that retaliation for complaints of discrimination was verboten. It's prohibited. Second element, is there a basis for imputing liability to the employer? Well, here certainly there is. All of the major players, the decision makers, were high-ranking management agents clearly acting within the scope of their employment. I don't think there's any dispute about that. And third, did they make a good faith effort to implement a policy, internal grievance policy, prohibiting discrimination? Well, no. In a word, there was no investigation. The appeal to Ron Ryan was a sham. With no investigation, if I were her boss, I'd fire her ass. Under Brusso, this is the type of sham appeal process internally which results in a finding of punitive damages, at least punitive damages being warranted. Now, in what amount? Well, the standard review on the amount...
Let me go back a minute. Even if they'd done an investigation according to the district judge, there would have been no discrimination anyway.
If they had done an investigation, we don't know what they would have found.
Well, at least you raised that issue on trial and the ruling that there wasn't any.
The judge at the lower level did in fact find that there was no discrimination. It would be presumptuous for me to say that an investigation would have found some. But the important point being that the internal grievance procedure they had in place was a sham. They didn't follow it. They ignored it because we're dealing with operations here. The sacred cow of Ryan International Airlines. And
well, isn't it true, too, that sometimes investigations may, as it were, resolve the problem, even if legal standards either are or are not met? I thought there was a great premium placed on the informal resolution process.
I would agree with that entirely, that had there been an investigation that had been presented to Ms. Fine, these are the results of our investigation, we may not be here today. We'll never know because the investigation was not done.
Do you accept there's a distinction between flight operations and regular employment actions?
I do not acknowledge or agree with that at all. I think that Ryan may make that, but I don't think the law would recognize that as being a valid differentiation.
So you're willing to have the, I've forgotten what her name is, make flight operations decisions?
Well, absolutely not, but I'm certainly willing, and I think their policy states as well that she should investigate allegations of discrimination that would then be presented to higher authorities, in this case Ron Ryan. Ron Ryan wasn't given a chance to make a decision about whether he'd fire her ass or not with an investigation having been conducted. He was simply shown the letter with no investigation done.
Well, she could have asked lots of the other pilots. She could have asked people who know how to fly what their view was, for example. She could have found out about how training is really done. I mean, asking questions is different from making the decision, surely.
Certainly, and there has been some comment in the briefing, at least, that she didn't as quickly as she should have bring these complaints of hers to the fore. One of the reasons that there was a delay, perhaps between the April event and the November letter or September letter, was that she did talk to other pilots. She talked to Kathy Schindler, who related another female pilot, although not quite as long or nearly as long with Ryan as before, who told her, Danny Looney rode with me, conducted a check of my abilities without even telling me that's what he was doing, and demoted me without even telling me that that was happening. I believe that this was done in an effort to keep me as a female pilot out of the front seats. And this is one of the things that Ms. Fine discovered in talking to other pilots about what's going on, and part of her reasonable belief. Getting to the issue of the excessiveness, or the alleged excessiveness, if this doesn't qualify as a retaliation case, I can't conceive what retaliation case would qualify for $294,000 of punitive damages. Absent physical violence, it's hard to think of a more egregious, at least for me to conceive, a more egregious case of retaliation that would justify $294,000. If this one doesn't, I don't know what would. Finally, if I might, on the point of reinstatement, there's an argument that we had waived reinstatement by waiving damages after January the 28th.
Thank you, counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.